is our broadcaster. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here. This is Yahweh's Covenant People. And unfortunately, I had misscheduled today's show accidentally for morning at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And so people straggling into the chat room. And yeah, I am tired. Had a very long day. So, but we'll get through this because this is one of my favorite subjects. And just to let everybody know, this is part three of Pagan Origins of Christmas, which I had misscheduled for this morning. And so we're just getting started now. And we're going to go into, I want to talk about the historicity of the Gospel of Luke, because it's the Luke story that contains the birth account and the early childhood account of Yahshua. The other Gospels don't seem to go into the early years of Jesus Christ. So, and it's really important to understand that the Gospel of Luke is, in fact, one of the most accurate, well, the whole Bible is actually the really accurate, and it can't be argued at all that the Bible is an inaccurate book. Of course, there are mistranslations, and those of you who have been listening to my shows understand exactly what that's all about. But there's also false accusations leveled against the Bible that it contains historical inaccuracies, and it doesn't. I would say every historical fact of the Bible that has been somebody has been able to verify it with archaeology or historical research has proven that the Bible is very accurate, very accurate. In fact, there's not a single case in which archaeology has disproven the Bible. So I'm going to start by this article, Ichthus, I-C-H-T-H-U-S. By the way, Ichthus is the fish symbol. It's a very difficult word to pronounce, the Ichthus. It's not the cross. The Ichthus, the fish symbol, was the first symbol of Christianity in the early days. So I'm going to be quoting ichthus.info/Luke. And here, let me just copy and paste it into the chat room for everybody. Okay. And you can follow along with me as we read from this document, which is very good. So in the incredibly accurate Dr. Luke, who was Luke? In one of his letters, Paul mentions Luke as being his friend and a doctor. Our dear friend Luke the doctor and Demas send greetings, Colossians 4:14. Of the four Gospels, Luke's Gospel is my favorite. I don't like something without a good reason. Luke was a scientist. Well, a doctor. let's not exaggerate here. Luke was a doctor, and the way he wrote the Gospel and Acts is from a scientific point of view, or he's a journalist from a journalistic point of view. He was checking his facts and made sure he knew what he was talking about. But most of the things he said were things that would be known to a resident of Judea in the days of Christ. And this document proves that he was very knowledgeable about current history in his time. So this speaks naturally to me. John's Gospel, on the other hand, is very emotional. Well, I don't know about that. I guess you could say it's dealing most carefully with the crucifixion and with the days leading up to the crucifixion, so it's very dramatic in that sense. That's fine for some emotionally inclined person or someone that can be moved to faith through emotion, but I am just too level-headed to be persuaded just by an emotional account. It needs historical accuracy for my scientific mind. However, once I believed, I can appreciate John's narrative. He talks about Jesus from a very personal perspective and also from a historical perspective. It's just that the details in John's Gospel are more personal and up close, where Luke happens to mention lots of historical... He's a name dropper, put it that way. Luke is a name dropper, and he gives... By dropping all these names and giving their titles, he actually anchors the New Testament in actual history. He continues, the purpose of Luke's gospel. Luke mentioned in the very beginning of his gospel that he wrote it with a specific purpose. Luke 1, verses 1 to 3, forasmuch as many have taken in hand to draw up a narrative concerning those matters which have been fulfilled among us, and us being Israel, even as they delivered them unto us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. It had to be Israelites because they were ministers of the word. It seemed good to me also, having traced the course of all things accurately from the first, to write unto thee in order, most excellent Theophilus. Like I said, he's a journalist. So Luke indicated that Luke wrote his gospel in an orderly way so that Theophilus could understand the things which had been fulfilled in the life and work of Yahshua. And if Theophilus could understand them, then we ought to be able to understand them too. His two books, Gospel of Luke and Acts, are really two parts of one continuous history of the life and work of Jesus, from the birth of John the Baptist down to about the year AD 60. Both books are historically incredibly accurate. It is so accurate that Luke has been called the greatest historian in history. Historical background information on Luke's work. To give you just an idea what I meant by historical background information, here is just a short list of things mentioned in Luke's work. Number one, Luke sets the events he records in dates using Roman emperor reigns. See Luke 2, verse 1. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. Now, this is a historical fact, and all you have to do to date this is go to the secular records to get an exact date for this. And see Luke 3, verse 1, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Acts 11, verse 28, one of them named Agabus stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. And this happened during the reign of Claudius. So this prophecy was fulfilled. Number four, and see Acts 18, verse 2. There he met a Judean or a Judahite named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Judeans to leave Rome. But and this is also a historical fact. Number five, Luke fixed the birth of Jesus in the reign of Emperor Augustus, when Herod the Great was king in Judea and Quirinius was governor of Syria. So again, Herod the Great was still alive, and I'm going to go into great detail on that subject after we're done with this article. And so quoting here, in the time of Herod, king of Judah, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abiah, and we talked about that extensively in the first couple of episodes. That fixes, because this was in the spring, fixing the conception of John the Baptist in the spring. That's Luke 1:5. In those days, it turned out to be in the summertime, so he was born in the spring. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world, and this was while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Luke 2:1-2, and a lot of critics. I'm tired. I have to start the show. But fortunately...
Oh, geez. Recorded live.
Thanks, Charlene. I would have missed that altogether. So, but it's still broadcasting on Eurofolk Radio. So that's a good thing. And so to continue our discussion here, I'm just going to continue as if I had not forgotten to hit the start button. Luke fixed the date of the beginning of the ministry of John the Baptist again by using a series of references to the rulers of time. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Etruria, and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, son of Zechariah, in the desert. Luke 3:1-2. So this is, he drops 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 names. All historical. All historical. And all of this can be verified. And the times can actually be precisely verified within a year or two. Number 7. In addition to the above references to historical figures, there was no calendar system in those dates, and the year of the emperor ruler is often used to indicate the year. Yes, in the 36th year of so-and-so, in the 10th year of so-and-so, in the 9th year of so-and-so, that's how they recorded time in years. Luke mentioned profusely about other historical figures at the time, Pontius Pilate many times, and of course Pontius Pilate is mentioned in all the Gospels, although maybe not in Mark. I'm not sure about Mark. Herod the Great and Bernice, Sergius Paulus, Drusilla, Gallio, Annas, Felix, Caiaphas, Festus, Ananias, King Herod Agrippa I, Gamaliel, King Herod Agrippa II, Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch of Galilee. And of course, these are all historical figures. Every last one of them can be verified. So it's really strange that there are still people who believe that Jesus is not a historical figure, even though all of the gospel accounts deal extensively with historical people who met Jesus, or in some cases killed Jesus, but certainly knew of Jesus and many of them who met Jesus. So the idea that all of these people, and certainly Caiaphas, because he's the one who sentenced him to death, that everybody knows that he existed, and that Herod existed, and the Herod Agrippa's existed, and all of these people knew of Christ. How in the world could these people, all of whom are historical figures, not be considered as relevant to whether Yahshua existed? So if Luke's account is so accurate with all of these people, why would he be lying about Yahshua Messiah? Well, he's not lying. And it's the skeptics who, well, just have to scratch their heads, because the proof that Luke is a very accurate historian continues. Luke's track record. So Luke included an incredible amount of historical information in his two works. He referred to hundreds of people and places in ancient history, like Derbe, Lystra, Lysanias, Annas, Caiaphas. By including all this historical information, Luke had given the skeptics plenty of reasons to criticize his gospel for accuracy. Because, well, okay, now here's something we can test, right? We know the gospel's no good, that the Bible is ahistorical, because he's got to be wrong about at least some of these things. For Luke's gospel was under a tremendous criticism for a long time. That was before archaeology came to Luke's defense. You have to understand that some people and places that Luke reported in his gospel were not very prominent. Some are city officials. There are no historical evidence or records that these people or places, some are tiny towns, existed. Well, they'll probably show up. Any writer who relates his story like this to the wider context of world history is asking for trouble if there are historical inaccuracies in his record, because he gives his critics many opportunities for testing his accuracy. Yes, and he will. They will find how accurate Luke really is. Luke was indeed under heavy criticism, especially concerning his reference to less prominent people such as tetrarchs, see below. Only the last century, when archaeology discovers many new facts of the new world, did Luke get his vindication. A lot of typos in this. Luke has not only withstood the test, but he is now considered to be a highly acclaimed historian, in fact, a great historian. Kenneth Woost, who we quoted last week in a different context, in Word Study in the Greek New Testament. That looks interesting. I'll have to click on that later. John Hitchin, National Principal, Bible College of New Zealand, and Miscellaneous. So there's three links there if you want to follow those and look at those real quick. Testimonials of Luke's accuracy. I have listed a number of the more extraordinary feats of Luke that showed that Luke had did, having traced the course of all things accurately from the first, he sure did. One of the greatest skeptics and also great archaeologists was the late Sir William Ramsay. He studied under the famous liberal German historical schools in the mid-19th century, probably some German Jews in there. Known for its scholarship, this school taught that the New Testament was not a historical document. With this premise, Ramsay investigated biblical claims as he searched through Asia Minor. What he discovered caused him to reverse his initial view. He wrote this: I began with a mind unfavorable to it, namely the Book of Acts. For the ingenuity and apparent completeness of the Tubingen theory had at one or Tubingen theory had at one time quite convinced me, the Tubingen theory being the skeptical theory, the scholars being located in Tubingen, Germany. It did not then in my line of life to investigate, or his chosen profession, I think is what he's trying to say here, to investigate the subject minutely. But more recently, I found myself often brought into contact with the Book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities, and society of Asia Minor. It was gradually borne in upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvelous truth. In William Ramsay, St. Paul the Traveler and the Roman Citizen, Luke's use of specialized titles. One of the most remarkable things about Luke's accuracy was his familiarity with the correct titles of all of the notable persons he mentioned. That is not an easy feat in those days. There was no encyclopedia or who's who or the internet to illustrate how the Germans call Hitler Der Führer, they called him. Example 1. And Führer means leader, of course. In Acts 13, verse 7, Luke addressed Sergius Paulus with the correct term antupa, translated deputy or proconsul. Example 2. In Acts 16, verse 19, Luke used the correct title archon, translated rulers or authorities. Example 3. In Acts 16, verse 35, he used the correct titles praetors and lictors, translated magistrates or sergeants or officers. Example 4. Luke correctly called Herod Antipas Tetrarch. On the other hand, Herod's Jewish subjects, and of course he had Jewish subjects as well as Judahite subjects, called him king. See Mark 6, verse 14. So, and some people say, well, since Mark calls him a king and Luke calls him a tetrarch, see, that's an error. Well, no, Mark was calling him what the Judeans called him, and Luke was calling him what the Romans called him. But Herod was never promoted to royal status by the emperor, and Luke is right to call him by the lower title, tetrarch. Example 5. One of the more famous examples of title that got Luke into trouble was his calling the rulers of a city in Thessalonica politarchs. See Acts 17, verse 6. Luke got into trouble with the liberal biblical scholars because the word politarchs was not found in any classical Greek literature. So Luke must have made it up, right? Skeptics use this as proof that Luke has no idea what he was talking about. How can Luke use a Greek word that is not used by anybody else? He must not know his Greek. Guess what? Archaeology proved that Luke used the right title. The fact that this title is only used for local officials in Thessalonica during a certain period in history made Luke's use of the word politarchs so unique. Luke was very precise in his word choice. So Luke knew more than these liberal theologians and historians, obviously. Supporting material, a webpage with the marble inscription of Politarch. Click on the link. Again, this is www.ichthus.info/Luke/intro.html. If anybody's interested in going to that site, listening to this, and there's a lot of links here that look very good. Luke on how the census was taken in Jesus' time. In Luke 2, 1 through 2, Luke gave a description of the way in which the census was carried out by the enrollment of all persons at their place of origin. In other words, you had to travel back home to enroll in the census, or either that or you had a note for your doctor to say, excuse me, I can't be there. In other words, everyone must go back to the place of their origin to be counted. Liberal biblical scholars criticize Luke as being fanciful. You will never do a census like that. It will upset the whole economic merchant system in the area by having the whole population move back to their place of origin just to be counted. That's just plain fantasy. It must be only a story without any historical truth behind it. Well, the liberal scholars had to swallow their words when the following edict from Vibius Maximus, prefect of Egypt, dated to the year 104 AD, was discovered. And it says this: the enrollment by household being at hand, it is necessary to notify all who for any cause soever are outside their nomes, administrative divisions of Egypt, to return to their domestic hearths, that they may also accomplish the customary dispensation of enrollment and continue steadfastly in the husbandry that belongs to them. In other words, yep, they had to go back home. I have a local webpage with more information about this edict. Lysanias, the Tetrarch of Abilene in the 15th year of Tiberius. Another hotly discussed topic in Luke's Gospel was the mentioning of Lysanias being Tetrarch of Abilene during the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar in Luke 3, verses 1 and 2, which we quote here. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Etruria, and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, son of Zechariah, in the desert. Luke 3, verses 1 through 2. Now he mentions two high priests, and of course there's only one high priest at a time. So they must have changed places. One of them must have taken over for the other during this period of time. Well, at that time, the only known Lysanias was only Lysanias known as king, who was executed by the order of Mark Antony. Remember Julius Caesar and Cleopatra in 34 BC? And there's a couple of, I guess it's two sides of the same coin. And by the way, it clearly shows a white man, and that's Lysanias, okay? It doesn't show a Negro. All black Hebrews take note. So for years, of course, there's no such thing as a black Hebrew, but they like to call themselves that. And that might be Elizabeth Taylor on the right, Queen Cleopatra. Might be. So for years, skeptics used this as an example to show that Luke does not know what he is talking about, because everyone knew that Lysanias was not a tetrarch, but rather the ruler of Chalcis, and he lived 50 years earlier. Once again, the skeptics had to eat their words when archaeology stepped in and found an inscription on a temple from the time of Tiberius, Emperor, from 14 to 37 AD, which named Lysanias as the Tetrarch of Abila near Damascus, just as Luke has written, and Luke was vindicated again. As I said earlier, the Bible has always been verified by archaeology, and all the critics can go to hell. They're wrong. The temple inscription reads, "For the salvation of the august lords and all of their household, Nymphaeus, freedman of Eagle, Lysanias Tetrarch established this street and other things." So they named a street after. Okay. So Lysanias named a street after this guy. And there's your monument. There's your monumental inscription. The reference August Lords is a joint title given only to the Emperor Tiberius, son of Augustus, and his mother Livia, widow of Augustus. This reference establishes the date of the inscription between A.D. 14 and 29. The year 14 was the year of Tiberius' accession to, and the year 29 was the year of Livia's death. So the 15th year of Tiberius is the year 29 A.D., and it lies within the reign of the August Lords, and Luke has been vindicated. Again, of course. Luke and the Roman historian Suetonius. One of the few passages of Luke's writing that still marveled me is Acts 18:2, where Luke reports, quote, "There he became acquainted with a Judean named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently arrived from Italy with his wife Priscilla. They had been expelled from Italy as a result of Claudius Caesar's order to deport all Judeans from Rome." I hope you felt the same curiosity as I did. Luke mentioned that Judeans were being expelled from Rome. Was that true? And if so, why? I went on the internet and started searching for clues, and it was just lucky that the Roman historian Suetonius did record this event in his work, Life of Claudius, and Suetonius also mentioned why, as the Judeans were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Christus, that is Christ, he, Claudius, expelled them from Rome. So we're talking about Judahites here because Jews would never have followed Yahshua Christos. Supporting material, click here. I was pleasantly surprised that the reason was due to the spread of Christianity. The first Christians were Judahites. Not Jews, Judahites. As far as I can tell, this event where Judahites are being expelled from Rome was mentioned by only two ancient writers, Luke and Suetonius. By the way, the skeptics could not accuse Luke of anything because Suetonius' writing was known to them. It's just odd that the skeptics did not take a hint from the fact that Luke's mentioning of such a strange event and Suetonius' confirmation of its accuracy, that Luke himself was very, very careful in his research. Final words? A prominent archaeologist carefully examined Luke's references to 32 countries, 54 cities, and 9 islands without finding a single mistake. Above, I have tried to show the accuracy that Luke had put into his writings. However, the main purpose of the Luke Gospel was not about the historical places, blah, 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 blah. Yet Luke has written it down carefully without errors. If Luke and other Gospel writers were so careful in the reporting of these secondary details, can you imagine how carefully they must have been in the reporting of the events of primary importance, namely the events of Yahshua Messiah, especially his teaching and resurrection? By the way, his suffering and resurrection indeed take up an unproportionately large part of the gospel, so that was clearly the main event. Now, of course, you can say that Luke and the other three gospel writers and all the other witnesses simply made it all up. But the fact is that many of these historical figures, such as Caiaphas and Annas, and of course Luke and the 12 apostles, all knew Jesus personally, and so did all the women of Jerusalem and Bethel and other towns around Jerusalem. So they're all accurate witnesses. So, but of course, we don't have any bones. We don't have any ossuary bones of Yahshua the Messiah. Why? Well, because he resurrected. There was nothing left of his physical body. But we have the ossuary bones of James and of St. Luke as well. The bones of St. Luke were transmitted to Padua, Italy, and the bones of James are still right there in Jerusalem. And the ossuary is James, brother of Jesus, it says on the little box. And his bones are in there. I don't know if anybody's done any DNA testing on those bones. They did do DNA testing on St. Luke's bones, and he was a white man, R1B1 DNA. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. I will try to show in the next few web pages that Luke was not kidding when he said he has carefully investigated everything, even the fact about a dead person coming back to life. And remember that Luke is a doctor, and he does know that dead people do not usually come back to life. Very good. All right, so just to let everybody know that the gospel accounts are accurate and totally reliable, and that's in the original Greek. Some of it was written in Aramaic, some of it was written in Hebrew, but the vast majority of this document, the New Testament, was written in Greek. So, let's go. Did Herod the Great really die in 4 BC? Let me copy this and put it in the chat box here. Again, this is from Hope of Israel, which is a website I've been quoting from a lot. Okay. Did Herod the Great really die in 4 BC? Placing Herod's death in 1 BC allows us to accept the ancient tradition that the Messiah was born in 3 BC. Actually, we went over this and we concluded it was 2 BC, September 29, 2 BC. But this gets us in the ballpark. The evidence of history, archaeology, and astronomy is now showing that Herod died in early 1 BC and that the Messiah was therefore born in 3 or 2 BC, regnal dating, as confirmed by Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Africanus, Hippolytus of Rome, Hippolytus of Thebes, Origen, Eusebius, and Epiphanius. By Juan Antonio Revilla and John D. Kaiser. There is a very generalized tendency to select the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction around 7 BC as the time of Messiah's birth. The alleged death of Herod in 4 BC has had a tremendous influence on this, being supported by 1. The three Herod successors seem to have started their reigns in 4 BC, implying that Herod died that year. 2. According to Flavius Josephus, Herod died between the lunar eclipse and the following Passover, and generally this has been accepted to be the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC. Number 3, Luke refers to an enrollment decree by Augustus, which is usually considered to be the tax call of 8 BC. 4, it is assumed that Dionysius Exiguus made an enormous mistake in 6 or 7 years in his calculations for the birth of the Messiah. The four statements above are not only arguable but highly improbable, and it is easy to show that other dates closer to the tradition 3 BC to 1 AD explain the evidence better. The discussion that follows is based mainly on John Mosley's When Was That Christmas Star? From the Griffith Observer, December 1980, and John Pratt's Yet Another Eclipse of Herod, the Planetarian, December 1990. Herod's Successors. We will start by quoting John Mosley regarding the time given to the beginning of Herod's successors' reigns. Herod suffered a grave political demotion in 4 BC as a result of a misunderstanding over raiders he sent to Arabia to suppress robbers hiding there. Augustus condemned Herod, removed his title Caesar's friend, Amic Caesarius, and relegated him to the lower position of subject. This loss of status was a serious matter. Its ramifications eventually included Herod's execution of his own son Antipater and others in a show of loyalty to Augustus. So this is how I show my loyalty to you, Caesar. I killed my own son. The execution, however, created a problem in political bookkeeping. Upon his fall from favor with Augustus, Herod had named Antipater as co-regent, Antipater being his son. And now the discredited Antipater's regnal years were no longer valid. And I think I read some of this previous, but I don't think I went into the whole article. Excuse me. Writes Paul R. Finch, from the time of Judas Maccabee until King Herod, the Judahites, not the Jews, were governed by the priestly family of the Hasmoneans. Now, why do I say Judahites, not Jews? Because the Judahites of the Maccabean period were the ones who came back from Babylon under Ezra and Nehemiah. And the first thing they did was to expel all the hybrids. They expelled all the hybrids, leaving only pure-blooded Judahites in the kingdom. Jews would never have done this because the Jews are a race-mixed breed of mongrels. So no mongrels allowed. And the books of Ezra and Nehemiah prove this conclusively. So they had to be Judahites, pure-blooded Judahites, no Edomite blood allowed. And in the, Apocrypha, the apocryphal book of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, it is recorded that these Judahites refused to circumcise non-Israelite males. Okay? The Jews will circumcise anything and call it a Jew, especially if it comes out of the womb of a Jewish woman. And then they will bite the foreskin off and suck the blood. That's how Jews do circumcision. Of course, the Judahites never did anything like that because they obeyed Yahweh's laws, at least with respect to that, right? And they were the priesthood was always enjoined to obey and teach Yahweh's laws. Well, whether the people obeyed or not is another story. But the Jews have never practiced Yahweh's laws, and they've always practiced the Talmud. So, this dynasty seemingly ended when Herod came to power, who was half Edomite and half Arab. Well, he was full Edomite, according to Josephus, not half and half. And just continuing down, Herod was never restored to the title of Caesar's friend. At the death of Alexander and Aristobulus, Antipater became co-ruler with his father and in no way different from a king. Josephus, Antiquities 17, paragraph 2. This was in 4 BC. Yet Antipater schemed to kill his father. When Herod heard about it, he recalled Antipater from Rome to try him. He was convicted of high treason, and Herod sent a request to Caesar to have him executed. Again, this is important because under Roman law, only the Romans could execute somebody or approve it. And that's what Pontius Pilate, that's what the Jewish Pharisees used Pontius Pilate for and threatened to falsely accuse him of being a traitor to Rome if he would fail to execute or at least fail to give the order. And you know the story. Pontius Pilate declared him innocent. He declared Yahshua innocent, and then he handed him over to the Pharisees. At that point, he really had no other choice because a riot would have ensued, and he understood the power of the Edomites and the Pharisees that they had with Caesar. Okay, let's continue. Herod at this time changed his will and completely expunged Antipater's name from memory. It is assumed by many that shortly after this, Herod died and was succeeded by Archelaus. But when Archelaus assumed power, he was reckoned by Josephus as one who had long exercised royal authority. Wars 2:26. Obviously, Archelaus reckoned his rule from 4 BC while Herod was still alive. And this is something that most historians are familiar with, that namely, as a king or regent gets older, he co-rules with his oldest son. So, and that's the way of the oldest son getting used to the office. So, especially when the reigning king, as he's getting older, begins to feel that he hasn't got much time left. So it's time to bring the son in and have him start learning the ropes. This fact has made historians, Ernest Martin, The Birth of Christ Recalculated, 1978 to 1980, suggested Herod's reign was seen to have officially ended with his disgrace, not death, in 4 BC, while his successors appropriated Antipater's regnal years and incorporated them into their own reigns. Numerous similar situations can be found in history. Yes, they can. Based on a conjecture that the Star of Bethlehem is the Jupiter-Saturn conjunction and that Herod the Great died in 4 BC, plus other conjectures concerning the tax call of 8 BC, ideas which are mere hypotheses are accepted as proven facts. Well, of course, with little to go on, historians tend to jump to conclusions. And we covered the census in Luke, showing it as absolutely Luke's information was absolutely accurate. Now, which lunar eclipse? Josephus mentions that Herod died in the interval between a lunar eclipse and the following Passover. For centuries, this has been thought to be the eclipse of March 13th, 4 BC. And this evidence of astronomy has had a large part in establishing the dogma that Herod died that year. Recent calculations, however, showed that this eclipse was only partial, 40% total and fairly hard to detect, and that the events narrated by Josephus to have occurred between this eclipse and the Passover that followed are impossible to fit in if one takes the 4 BC date. The total eclipses of January 9 and 10, 1 BC, and December 29, 1 BC, however, eliminate these problems. To determine which lunar eclipse was the correct one, one needs to know that lunar eclipses happen only when there is a full moon and only with a frequency of 3 times a year. The eclipse of January 10th, 1 BC, is listed as the eclipse number 1860 in Theodor Opelozer's Canon of Eclipses. That eclipse, according to John Pratt, was listed as a total eclipse for 51 minutes near midnight and centered over 15 degrees east longitude, which is perfect for having been viewed in Jerusalem. The eclipse of August 5th was over the Pacific Ocean and not visible in Jerusalem, while the one of December 29th was only partial. Now, it's also possible that the Magi noticed this eclipse as well over Jerusalem if they were looking from the east, as the so-called Star of Bethlehem was visible to them, probably also over Jerusalem. Ernest Martin notes that the eclipse of Josephus had to have been that one of January 9th and 10th, 1 BC. All the events mentioned by Josephus fit quite comfortably with this eclipse, and only with this eclipse. In fact, everything fits beautifully in other ways. There is a Judahite document called the Megillah Tanith, Scroll of Fasting, which was composed initially not long after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So in this case, it could have been Jewish, because the Jews, the other sect, the Sadducees, had ceased to exist, and only the Pharisees were still hanging around during 70 AD. And they were driven to parts all over the Middle East when the Roman army destroyed the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. This scroll mentions, so certainly there were Judahites in the area of Jerusalem at this point, but the Edomite Pharisees would have been the ones in leadership positions. So this scroll mentions two semi-festival days during which no mourning was permitted. One is Kislev 7. The month of Kislev corresponds in most years with our December. The other commemorative day was Shabbat 2. This month answers to our late January or early February. No one knows why these 2 days of feasting are commemorated, yet they must have been days of joy ordained before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. An early Jewish commentator who probably lived in the 7th century wrote a brief remark to Kislev 7, the day of Herod's death. So, in other words, there's all kinds of commentaries available to us that suggest that the 1 BC eclipse is the correct one. Okay, impossible time constraint is the next heading. The proponents of the theory that Herod died in 4 BC pretend that the following events all happened within 30 days. Part of Herod's body was putrefied and bred worms. Well, that could happen in a couple of minutes, right? He is taken on a round trip to warm baths 16 kilometers away. Number two, he orders all important men in all villages to come to Jerusalem, so a distance of 120 to 30 kilometers. His son Antipas is executed, and Herod dies 5 days later. There is a magnificent funeral, and the body is carried 37 kilometers. A 7-day mourning period starts, followed by a funeral feast. Four, another mourning period is planned and executed for the patriots killed. So the 4 BC presumption requires that all of these events took place in a mere 30 days. Dr. Craig Chester elaborates on this. Herod was sick at the time of the execution of the rabbis, and his condition worsened almost immediately. So they weren't rabbis, they were Judahite priests. He was treated for a time, and the doctor simply refers to them as rabbis, because only Jews are called rabbis. In fact, Jesus himself said, "Be not called rabbi." So he refused to be called by that title. He was treated for a time by his physicians to no avail. He then decided to pack up the royal household and move to Jericho to take the baths. He tried the baths unsuccessfully for some days and then returned to Jerusalem. So he must have been in agony. Of course, his body was full of worms. Believing that he soon would die, Herod came up with a diabolical plan to ensure that all of Judea would mourn his death. So just in case people hate me so much that they won't have a funeral for me, I will insist that people do, in spite of his unpopularity. He commanded the leading men from around the country to come to Jerusalem, where he imprisoned them in the Hippodrome and ordered the army to execute them as soon as he was dead. Well, how are you going to get a parade when you kill everybody? Judea would indeed mourn, he vowed, but not for him. Fortunately, the order was not carried out. Yeah, hard to do that posthumously. Everybody hated Herod so much because he was an Edomite Jew. In the meantime, word arrived from Rome that Herod finally had the emperor's permission to execute his rebellious son Antipater, and he promptly complied. 5 days later, Herod died, but not before decreeing that his to be the largest funeral ever held in the history of the world. His body was embalmed. I guess the worms were embalmed too. The army was assembled to carry his body in the funeral procession to a burial site some 25 miles away. The soldiers walked in bare feet, as was required, when in mourning, traveling 1 mile a day. So they really couldn't get there for 25 days. So the assumption that all this happened in 30 days is obviously untenable. Only then came the Passover. The 29 days between the eclipse of 4 BC and the following Passover simply did not allow enough time for all of the events to occur. Okay. A minimum of 10 weeks would have been required, as Ernest Martin and others showed very carefully. Therefore, the 4 BC date fails to account for what Josephus recorded. But on January 10th, 1 BC, there was a total lunar eclipse visible in Jerusalem, which happened near midnight and lasted 51 minutes, more than enough time to be observed by most people in the city. Okay, guest 8, when are you going to get destroyed in another debate with Charles Giuliani? Well, as I recall, it was Giuliani who got destroyed. And he can debate me anytime. I'll destroy him again. He just made totally unsubstantiated claims about the Bible, none of which he could back up. It was just his opinion. That's right, guest 8, though. You must be Giuliani. The Pater Patriae. In the temple of Augustus at Ankara, an inscription was found referring to a census in the year 8 BC. The relationship of this tax call with the enrollment of Joseph and Mary was an unfounded conjecture, since it would apply only to Roman citizens. And it is even more conjectural to imagine that Mary would have traveled so far because the taxes would apply only to Joseph. So what we're seeing here, obviously, the historians are still taking leaps as to what actually happened. On the other hand, historians have identified a combination of a census and an oath of allegiance that would have effectively involved Mary and Joseph, done between the years 3 and 2 BC. As the result of an imperial decree related to the bestowal of the title, Pater Patriae, on Augustus by the Senate on February 5th of the year 2 BC. Josephus recorded that nearly 6,000 Pharisees refused to take the oath approximately 1 year before Herod died, and Orazio, a historian of the 5th century, clearly links this oath to the enrollment of Joseph and Mary. Okay, yeah, I'll get in touch. I'll get in touch with Giuliani. I'll destroy him again. Thank you, guest 8. Augustus ordered that a census be taken, because he's the one who doesn't believe that the Bible is historically accurate. And I've been proving this to show that it is. Augustus ordered that a census be taken of each province everywhere and that all men be enrolled. So at that time, he also says Yahweh approves of human sacrifice. Yeah, that's what he argues. But he didn't prove it, he just argued it. So at that time, Christ was born and was entered on the Roman census list as soon as he was born. This is the earliest and most famous public acknowledgement, which marked Caesar as the first of all men and the Romans as lords of the world. That first and greatest census was taken, since in this one name of Caesar, all the peoples of the great nations took oath, and at the same time, through the participation in the census, we made a part of one society, were made part of one society, quoted by John Pratt. So obviously this obviously couldn't have taxed the whole world or counted the whole world. It's only talking about the Greco-Roman world. Later, Orosio identifies the time of the census using two Roman systems that agreed among themselves, implying a lower limit for the death of Herod on the basis of this evidence of 2 BC. This census would have included Joseph and Mary, even though they were not Roman citizens, being of royal lineage of the houses of David, or the house of David. Both Joseph and Mary would have had to go specifically to Bethlehem to enroll. Augustus' decree. Now, by the way, if a troublemaker is still here, this proves it can't be a Bethlehem in the land of the 10 northern tribes. It had to be Bethlehem in Judah, because that's the only one that still existed. The other one, there weren't any people living in Bethlehem of the 10 lost tribes. So this is further evidence, troublemaker, that you're wrong, that Bethlehem, Judah, is in fact the correct city. All right, but Joseph and Mary would have had to go specifically to Bethlehem to enroll, and there was no Bethlehem in the tent in the territory of the old northern tribes. It was totally occupied by the Assyrians and now by the Romans. Augustus, the only one left was the only one left was Bethlehem, Judah. That's the only one. Augustus' decree required that all adults pledge their goodwill to Caesar, and the complete enrollment was presented to him as part of the celebrations. Nevertheless, the proponents of the theory that Herod died in 4 BC keep repeating over and over again that Dionysius was wrong, even though nobody has ever explained why. It is an assumption based on a false premise, because Herod did not die in 4 BC, but in the year 1 BC. The assertion regarding the year 4 BC is refutable on many grounds, and Ernest Martin in 1978 carefully showed its virtual impossibility, of which I have mentioned only the main arguments in the summary. By the way, his book, Ernest L. Martin's The Star That Astonished the World, I've been trying to find an online version, but apparently it's not available. Troublemaker, you're wrong. Bethlehem, Judah existed before the 10 northern tribes even occupied the northern territory of Israel. Just consult your Bible. It was there. Jacob visited it. Joseph visited it. Bethlehem, Judah was already there, troublemaker. I don't see how you can. You're not reading your Bible. Dionysius Exiguus and Luke in error. I have already mentioned that many accused Dionysius Exiguus of being wrong by 4 years in his time of the birth of the Messiah. This, however, is a myth and finds no support whatsoever among competent historians. The astronomer and chronologist John Pratt has come to the same conclusion. No satisfactory answer, it appears, has been proposed to this long-standing puzzle. This is what John Moseley wrote back in 1980. Incidentally, it is often claimed that Dionysius Exiguus made a 4-year error in calculating the date of birth of Christ by forgetting to allow for the 4 years that Augustus ruled under his original name, Octavian. Although this claim has been sanctioned by time, it appears to be a myth and finds no support whatsoever among historians. Dionysius was a prominent scholar who lived in Rome in the 6th century and who had access to accurate records, including many now lost to us. The reigns of the emperors were well known, and he was certainly aware of Augustus' change of name. Dionysius carefully selected the date of December 25th, 1 BC, for the birth of Christ, and accounted for the commencement of the Christian era with January 1, 1 AD, 6 years later. So this is where we get the original. This is where we get the original date of December 25th, 1 BC, from a non-Israelite. To agree with the start of the Roman year and was probably much closer to the truth than we have given him credit. Well, that's Pratt's speculation, because we know it was around September 29th, 2 BC. According to the theory, erroneously accepted as fact, not only Dionysius was wrong, but also Luke. No, Luke was not wrong. Regardless of his care in recording information that would help to establish a historical perspective, since at the time of baptism, according to them, the Messiah was about 36 years old. What? At the time of baptism? No, Luke says he was 30, and since he was born in, let's see, we can round 29 BC to 1 BC, and if he was crucified in 33 AD, then he lived 30 years before being baptized and lived 3.5 years while he did his ministry. So Luke is correct when he says 30. Okay, Troublemaker says that Tucker has refused to debate. Well, that's his problem. Troublemaker, you and I debated this question long ago, and as I recall, I won the debate. But you're welcome to debate me again. We can start from the very beginning, and I prove to you from Scripture that Bethlehem, Judah, existed before the 10 tribes occupied their territory. According to the theory, erroneously accepted, not only was Dionysius, no, Luke wasn't wrong. I don't know where he's getting this from. But anyway, the astronomical evidence. Let's get to the astronomical evidence. And let's see, we've got 30 minutes left. What astronomical events possibly in the years 3 or 2 BC might have been related to the Star of Bethlehem? A nova, and I've read a lot about novas happening in those times, and there was a nova recorded in that area. The unexpected sudden brightening of a star from invisibility into a bright object for a period of days or weeks has been suggested, but he says there is no historical record of such a nova. In fact, there is a record, and they gave it a number, and that number, because a nova leaves after effects, and its after effects are still visible. Nor is it clear why a nova's astrological significance would be. Well, it's, let me put it this way. It's possible that the Magi were astrologers, but it's more likely they were simply priests who used astronomy because they were Judahites of Pharez ancestry. Origen himself suggested a comet, but for comets to appear sporadically, move, and can even seem to point down to the Earth. But the recorded comets around this time, even Halley's Comet, was not very impressive. Conjunction of planets have also been considered good possibilities. A conjunction is a close apparent approach between two celestial objects, technically speaking. A conjunction occurs at the moment when both objects have the same celestial longitude. One is due north of the other. The closer the objects, the more visually impressive the event and the more significant astrologically. In 3 BC and 2 BC, there was a series of those close conjunctions involving Jupiter. The planet represented kingship and coronations, and the birth of kings. In the Judean world, Jupiter was known as Tzedek or righteousness, a term used for Messiah. On September 14th, 3 BC, and on February 17th and May in 2 BC, Jupiter, the king planet, stood next to Regulus, the brightest star in Leo, which also represented royalty, and Regulus means little king. Then came a climax to the display. On June 17th, 2 BC, Venus and Jupiter, the two brightest planets in the solar system, appeared to collide. They stood an incredible 1/50th of a degree apart, and seemed to fuse into one immense ball of light. So this would be a pretty impressive sight in the sky. In fact, we have seen here only the highlights of an impressive series of planetary motions and conjunctions fraught with a variety of astrological meanings, involving all the other known planets of the period, Mercury, Mars, and Saturn. But if now there was a lot of Saturn worship going on. There was a lot of Saturn worship going on in the ancient pagan world. And that's where you get your hexagon from, because Saturn has a hexagon at its north pole, very interestingly. And that's probably, and of course, a hexagon would be inside of a hexagram, which is your six-pointed star of the Jews, star of Remphan, which is a reference to Saturn. But if the planet Jupiter was the star of Bethlehem or was a component of the events that triggered the visit by the Magi, how do we view the final appearance of the star on their journey to Bethlehem? It would have been in the southern sky, though fairly high above the horizon. Could the star have stopped over Bethlehem? The answer is yes. The word stop was used for what we now call a planet's stationary point. A planet normally moves eastward through the stars from... Wait a minute. They rise in the east and set in the west. So it moves westward. They rise in the east and set in the west. Through the stars from the night to night and month to month, but regularly exhibits a retrograde loop. Now, not regularly, on occasion, it exhibits a retrograde. And that is when a more distant star appears to be moving backwards. And that's because a closer star appears to be passing it up. So that makes the distant star look like it's going backwards, but it's not going backwards, it's just going slower than the closer star. But what happens is as the Earth goes around the sun, you can see this conjunction from two different points as the Earth is moving towards the two stars, and then moving around and eventually moving away from the two stars. That's what causes, as it goes around in its semicircular loop, completing its orbit, that's when you see a retrograde motion. And this is very common and can only be explained by the global planet theory. It can't be explained by flat Earth theory. After it passes the opposite point in the sky from the sun, it appears to slow, coming to a full stop and moving backward, westward through the sky for some weeks. Again, it slow stops and resumes. He's got these directions backwards. Everything rises in the east and sets in the west. This is caused by the orbits of Jupiter and the Earth, as the Earth and Jupiter take up the slack, as it were, in their orbital differences. This gives the Earth sky viewer the illusion that Jupiter is reversing its movement. So in other words, there were three conjunctions of Jupiter and Venus and whatever other stars were involved here, which is pretty spectacular. Okay. The conjunctions of Venus and Jupiter in 3 and 2 BC around the fixed star Regulus, which again means little king, were impressive and unique celestial phenomena. Since the ephemeris of Brian Tuckerman were published, the ephemerides were published in the mid-60s, allowing the experts to know this fact, Jupiter, Venus have been the preferred alternative for the star of Bethlehem in the mind of many astronomers and historians. And since the publication of Ernest Martin's Birth of Christ, scholars have acknowledged the difficulties with the 4 BC date for the death of Herod. And about the enrollment alluded to by Luke, Martin showed that this is not a tax call of 8 BC, but a census and oath of allegiance, which we covered in the first article, ordered to celebrate Augustus Caesar's Silver Jubilee, who is going to receive the title of Pater Patriae. All these points have been widely discussed and explained in recent literature. I feel that ignoring them and preferring other hypotheses that contradict tradition is a matter of psychology related to the unconscious or very conscious need to assume that the church manipulated everything or that the ancients were wrong and we are right. Of course, he's talking about modern so-called scholarship. Excuse me. The Question of Quintilius Verus. Again, and the reason I'm going through this also is to show the extreme accuracy of the scriptures in their original languages. They never fail. The scriptures never fail. It's only poor translations and bad interpretations that fail. Sometimes, for example, the argument is made that Josephus records Quintilius Verus as governor of Syria when Herod died, and Verus is shown as such on coins from 4 BC. The problem with this evidence, as Pratt explains for Martin, is that the coins also show Verus governing in Syria in 6 and 5 BC, while Josephus recorded Saturninus as governor during the two following years. Martin mentions an inscription found near the Verus village describing a man who was governor of Syria twice, probably referring to Verus, since his second term would correspond to 1 BC, and there is no record of any other person ruler that year. Okay, so here we are. It's verified again that the gospel is true and accurate. According to Paul Finch, Josephus tells us that Quintilius Verus had taken over the governorship when Antipater, the heir to King Herod, had returned from Rome to Jerusalem, and that he succeeded Saturninus as governor of Syria. And that's Antiquities 17, paragraph 89. But coins have been found which show that Verus was legate of Syria in the 25th, 26th, and 27th years of the Actian year era, that is the Battle of Actium, from which much of ancient history is dated. I believe that was 29 BC, or might have been 31 BC, not quite sure, Battle of Actium. This is where historians trip up and conclude that they have proof that Herod must have died in 4 BC, because Verus is shown to have been active in 4 BC. But the answer is dangling right before their eyes and they cannot see it. An inscription known as the Lapis Tiburtinus speaks of governor of Syria during the time of Augustus, who had been governor twice. Many have tried to identify this inscription with Quirinius in order to show that he held office before his 6 AD tenure. But Professor Syme has shown that Quirinius is impossible. The Titulus Tiburtinus in Vestia Acton book that he wrote. L.R. Taylor suggests that Titius is the subject of this inscription, but Syme has shown that Titius would have been much too old to receive the ornamento triumphalia given only after 12 BC. Yet the inscription was found only a stone's throw from Verus Via in Tiber. Okay, it's right next door. So it can't be a reference to Verus, right? It's too close. So the reason some scholars object to Verus is that the inscription refers to Augustus as divine, which was bestowed on him at his death in AD 14, whereas Verus died in AD 9. But because Verus was defeated in Germany, he was never commemorated while Augustus lived. Yet when Tiberius came to power, who was Verus' brother-in-law, Tiberius went to the battlefield to bring back the fallen Verus remains, and his memory was restored as a defender of the empire. Therefore, this objection is weak in the extreme. So, any possible objections that skeptics of the Bible have put forth, every single one of them is blown out of the water. Every single one. Okay, no name calling, please. No name calling in the chat room. We try to stick with facts here. This brings us to Publius Sulpicius Quirinius, who conducted the enrollment. Luke says that he was governor, yet Quirinius was not officially governor until AD 6. But it does seem probable that Quirinius may have been a provisional governor in 3 and 2 BC, while the actual legate was away at Rome. Indeed, Justin Martyr called Quirinius the procurator of Syria in his Apology 134. The Cambridge Ancient History tells us that each province had its equestrian procurator, who in the eyes of the provincials was almost as important as the governor himself. Quirinius in the record seems to have been a man Friday by all accounts. Tacitus said that his command in the war of the Homonidenses was a special command. An inscription mentions him as holding an honorary municipal office at Antioch by the Pisidia. He also became guardian of Gaius Caesar, the heir to the empire, when Gaius acquired residential authority at Antioch over the eastern provinces in AD 1 from Tacitus Annals, chapter 3, paragraph 48. Tacitus also said that Quirinius was one who had considerable talents for business. In AD 2, he married Aemilia Lepida, a descendant of Sulla and Pompey. This, no doubt, gave him much more political standing, and in AD 6, he became legate of Syria upon the death of Archelaus, Archelaus being one of the sons of Herod, at which time, or maybe, I'm sorry, it might have been, trying to think of the last pure Judahite king, but more than likely he was a son of Herod, at which time Judea was annexed. This change in government gave reason for Quirinius' second census of Judea mentioned in Acts 5:37. This is why Luke distinguished the registration at the time at which Judea was annexed. And this, the registration at the time of Jesus' birth being the first one while he was provisional governor of Syria, which Justin Martyr said was actually while he was procurator. Okay, so different terminology of names. But as we just saw in an earlier document, Luke has been proven accurate with his terminology in every single case. Finch goes on to say, flat earth debating going on in the chat room. But who was the actual governor at this time? The early Christian apologist Tertullian, living in the late second century, who was by profession a lawyer and well acquainted with Roman governmental affairs, said that the census that brought Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem was conducted when Sentius Saturninus was governor of Syria, in his answer to the Judeans, chapter 8. What's more, he said it occurred in the 41st year of Augustus answering to 3 or 2 BC. Indeed, the early Christian sources were nearly united in stating that Jesus was born somewhere between 3 and 2 BC, and we also, or 2 BC, we found it was late 2 BC. The list includes Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Africanus, Hippolytus of Rome, Hippolytus of Thebes, and Cassiodorus, senator, from Finnegan's Handbook of Biblical Chronology. These chronologies come in handy, don't they? This is strong testimony indeed, because these sources were able to consult the vast libraries at their disposal, which modern historians no longer have access to. But the next best thing to having access to these vital records is to accept the testimony of those who did. Modern scholarship has disgraced itself in an utterly unprofessional way by ignoring this testimony in favor of our present fragmentary knowledge for this period. And of course, very few of these so-called scholars actually consult the Apocrypha, which are a goldmine of historical information, an absolute goldmine. With this missing piece of evidence, we can now reconstruct a succession of Syrian governors as follows. M. Titius, 13 to 7 BC. Number 2, Procurator Quintilius Verus, 7 to 4 BC. Number 3, Sentius Saturninus, 4 to 2 BC. And then again, Procurator Quintilius Verus a second time, 2 BC to AD 1, and 5, C. Caesar, AD 1 to 4. Based upon the writings of Flavius Josephus, who was a Judahite, not a Jew, which have proven to be highly accurate, and the the mainstream and secular historians have always assumed that Josephus was not a very good historian, because his dates disagree with theirs. But he was there. And these people looking back need to check, double check their facts rather than jumping to false conclusions. And he is right. The writings of Flavius Josephus have been proven to be highly accurate. Now, of course, he couldn't know everything either, so Josephus did make some mistakes. But I'd say 95 to 99% of what he wrote is accurate, and a lot of it is actually a recapitulation of the Old Testament leading up to, and he fills in the value of Josephus, the tremendous value of Josephus, is he fills in a ton of details during the intertestamental period between the ending of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New. So Josephus, the Judahite historian, and the Apocrypha, which were in the original King James Bible, and still are, you can still get that type of King James Bible with the Apocrypha. I have a couple of editions myself. That this is invaluable historical information. And you cannot understand. These documents tell us how the Pharisees, who began as a sect among the Judahites of the Maccabean period, gradually became traitors and sided with the Romans, and then were taken over by Edomites in the days of Herod. So just as we have the Republicans and Democrats being taken over by Edomites today, that's how the original Pharisees and that's how the Sadducees were taken over. And then the Pharisees became a completely Jewish, that is, Edomite sect by the time of 70 AD. And what were they doing? They were leading the Israelites and Judahites around by the nose, just as they are doing today, by pretending to be Israel. So let me start this paragraph over. Based upon the writings of Flavius Josephus, which have been proven to be highly accurate, and the calculations of relevant lunar events, it is clear that Herod the Great died in 1 BC, not 4 BC. Placing Herod's death in 1 BC allows us to accept the ancient tradition that the Messiah was born in 2 BC. The four earliest Christian writers who report the date of the Messiah's birth are Irenaeus, late 2nd century, Clement of Alexandria, about 200 AD, Tertullian, early 3rd century, and Africanus, early 3rd century. Africanus specifies the date in terms that can be understood as 3 or 2 BC. Both Irenaeus and Tertullian assign Yeshua's birth to the 41st year of Augustus. If this date presumes that the reign of Augustus began when he was elevated to consulship in August 43 BC, the year intended is 2 BC. Tishri 1, 3 BC to Tishri 1, 2 BC, which is the biblical reckoning. Tertullian conveniently confirms this conclusion by adding that the Messiah's birth was 20 years after the death of Cleopatra and 15 years before the death of Augustus. Cleopatra died in August 30 BC, and Augustus died in August AD 14. So we have very clear historical evidence that Yahshua Messiah was in fact born in late 2 BC. The evidence of history, archaeology, and astronomy is now showing that Herod died in early 1 BC and that the Messiah was therefore born, 3/2 BC. We know it was late 2 BC, closer to 1 BC than 3 BC. Regnal dating, as confirmed by Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, and a whole bunch of others, and even Eusebius, who is the, Eusebius wasn't really a Catholic. The Catholics claim him. He actually reports a lot of things that the Catholics don't like to admit to, such as the fact that Catholicism had incorporated all kinds of pagan imagery into their religion. So here we come to the end of this document, and let me just go back here. And there's one other document about the historicity and the reliability of Luke. And Luke's Accuracy, Some Unfinished Business. And I'm going to put this article in the chat box here. Some Unfinished Business. And he quotes from Acts 17:11, they received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. So it's really obvious that the Israelites had copies of the scriptures to check whether or not Yahshua fulfilled all the prophecies. Now, the Israelites of the time, most of them were Greek speakers and Aramaic speakers. And we're told that copies of the Hebrew Old Testament were few and far between, and probably only the Pharisees had access to them. And they prevented other people from accessing those. And eventually, I'm sure they stole them and took these Pharisees, who eventually became known as rabbis, Jewish rabbis, do possess these copies of the ancient Hebrew Old Testament. The document that the Israelites used was the Septuagint, which was translated roughly 250 BC under the Greek rulers of Egypt. And so that was translated directly from the Hebrew into the Greek. And so their records would have been the Septuagint. So, Luke's Accuracy, Some Unfinished Business by Wayne Jackson. The story came to me this way. In the fall of 1992, Notre Dame and Boston College contested one another in football. What's this got to do with the Bible? It was a one-sided rout as Notre Dame demolished its opponent. Even in the second half, well ahead in points, the Fighting Irish kept running the score up, contrary to that unspoken rule of good sportsmanship. Sometime later, it is said the coach of Boston College was offered a position with the National Football League. He got bumped upstairs. The job would have meant more money, greater prestige, etc. Surprisingly, however, it was turned down. The coach wryly commented, "I have some unfinished business." The next year, Boston College defeated number one ranked Notre Dame. Business finished. When I heard that report, I thought of a similar circumstance of many years ago. Sir William Ramsay, who we met in the previous article, had been educated at the universities of Aberdeen, Scotland, and at Oxford. In his theological pursuits, however, he had fallen victim to the radical theories of German critics like F.C. Bauer. I haven't had time to research whether this guy Bauer is a Jew or not. He came to question the historical accuracy of the New Testament. He thus decided he would do on-site research in some of the Bible lands, where he fully expected to disprove the scriptures in numerous particulars. Accordingly, in 1890, he set out on his adventure. As he examined the historical references in the New Testament, especially the book of Acts, amazingly, he discovered that time after time, the biblical writers were correct. And the modernistic criticisms that had been hurled against the sacred volume were baseless. And so, in 1895, he wrote a book titled St. Paul, the Traveler and Roman Citizen. By the way, Yahshua was reckoned as a Roman citizen. Remember when he paid the tax? He paid the tax by pulling a coin out of a fish's mouth. I wish I could pay my taxes that easily. In which he strongly defended the accuracy of the inspired historian Luke relative to the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. A liberal critic reviewed Professor Ramsay's book and concluded his discussion with this barb. If Luke is a great historian, what would the author of this book, Ramsay, make of Luke 2, verses 1 through 3? Ramsay mused. Nothing more was needed. This brief question was sufficient. The Bearing of Recent Discovery on the Trustworthiness of the New Testament, page 223. The learned scholar had some unfinished business. He would determine whether Luke 2:1 was correct or not. After his investigation, he penned the volume just cited. For many years, Luke 2:1-7 had been perceived as containing more error per square inch than almost any other section of the New Testament. Thanks to the work of Sir William Ramsay, those objections have vanished, every one of them. And I might be able to get these all in within the 5 minutes left to us here. It was alleged that Luke erred in assigning Bethlehem of Judea as the birth of Christ. That troublemaker still makes that assumption. There was a Bethlehem in Zebulun of Galilee. You're absolutely right, troublemaker. There was a Bethlehem in Zebulun of Galilee. Obviously, Luke had confused the two cities. No, Luke got it right. But the critics were wrong. The Old Testament had prophesied that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem of Judea. Read Micah 5:2. And the Hebrew people entertained this expectation. Read John 7:42. Furthermore, Matthew, as an independent writer, confirms that Jesus was born in the southern Bethlehem. That's Matthew 2, verse 1. Objection number two. It was charged that Luke had erred in suggesting that all the world was to be enrolled. Now, here we go again. All the world. What's all the known world? All the world under Roman jurisdiction, not the entire planet. But the Greek word for world is oikoumene, not the cosmos of John 3:16. And even there, the cosmos of John 3:16 is not necessarily the entire world. In fact, in John 3:16, it's only talking about the cosmos of Israel. Now, oikoumene, which merely signified the world of the Roman Empire. Objection number three. The critics argued that since Herod the Great was king over Judea, Matthew 2, 1 and 22, the Judahites, or the Judeans properly translated, the Judeans of that region would not have been subject to Roman taxation. However, Herod was only a vassal king, ultimately subject to Rome. When Archelaus, Matthew 2:22, was deposed from his throne in AD 6, Roman procurators were appointed to administer the affairs of the country and to procure the tax money. Number four, it was claimed that Augustus never ordered a general census of the Roman Empire, but Luke actually never made such a claim. When he states that all the world should be enrolled, he employed a present tense verb, i.e. the ruler ordered the adoption of the practice of enrollment. Rather than alluding to a specific enrollment, he says nothing about how the decree was implemented. And of course, we covered that in a previous document from an Egyptian source showing that such a decree actually did exist. Number five, Luke also contends that the census at the time of the Lord's birth was the first one. Was he right? Ancient records reveal that there was a census conducted every 14 years. Acts 5:37 mentions another one of these, but the one alluded to in Luke 2:2 was indeed the first. Number six, it was alleged that Quirinius was not governor of Syria at the time of Christ's birth, but the word governor, hegemoneo, is a generic term, and an archaeological evidence has shown that in some sense Quirinius was twice a ruler in Syria, the first of which can be reconciled with Luke 2:2, which we covered in detail in the previous document as well. Number seven, it was claimed that the enrollment did not require everyone to return to his own city. A document from Egypt, which we cited, has shown that during that time, all for who any cause are outside their homes must return to their domestic hearths, that they may also accomplish the customary dispensation of enrollment. Since there was a cultural parallelism between Egypt and Palestine, there is no reason to question Luke's accuracy on this point. And the author concludes, the inspired writer has been vindicated in every particular. Business finished. Amen. Business finished. Amen. Okay, this, I think, now next time, since just I didn't plan this, next Friday is going to be Christmas Day, I'm going to quote from Bertrand Comparé and from Dr. Wesley Swift and possibly other identity teachers giving their opinion of Christmas. So this has been a very enjoyable series so far for me, because I love Bible history. I just love Bible history. Can't get enough of it. And this is excellent stuff, folks. So previously mentioned person wants to debate me, I'm not talking about Troublemaker, I'm talking about Charlie Giuliani. If Charlie Giuliani wants to debate me on any question of historical accuracy of the Bible, have him contact me, elijames@att.net, and we will set it up. We'll have more than fun. Okay, I'll see if I can find the first link. See if I can copy it. For some reason, the program doesn't allow me to post the same link twice, but let's give it a go. It's Charles Giuliani is a skeptic of the Bible. Okay. All right, folks. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. Boy, this 90 minutes went fast, and I'm not tired anymore. Now I won't be able to go to sleep for 5 hours. But anyway, thanks for listening. Don't forget to join in. Tomorrow, Restoration Hour, I'm going to do my final episode on the Muranos. And then on One-to-One, David James and I will do another episode on the Book of Revelation. Both of those episodes should be very entertaining and enjoyable and historically accurate. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. Good night. Good night.
Call recording has been completed.